Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It is Thursday, March 8th. If you are celebrating a birthday today, happy birthday. You're sharing it with one of the monkeys, Mickey Dolenz. He's 73 today. Do you know what instrument he played on the monkeys? Huh? Anybody in the studio? Okay, Paul's making drum motions. Way to go, Paul Perreault. He was the drummer for the monkeys. I was kind of a fan of that show. I kind of thought that was kind of fun. And how about a little passage from Isaiah today with Peter and myself here in the studio? Peter Capron is going to be joining me in just a minute. He grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. See? Feel right at home, don't we?
I thought you were actually speaking to me at first, but then I realized it was a messianic passage, and so then I knew what it was about. Yeah,
right, right.
Yeah.
All right. Just so you know, there are no original thoughts, and for the record, I was the first person to say that. Let me take a break. When we come back, we'll bring Peter Capster in. It is 5 minutes after the hour.
Showing photographs of every head he's had the pleasure to know, and all the people that come and go, stop and say.
And of course, that theme song belongs to Dr. Peter Capster. That, of course, is Billy Preston. Nothing from nothing leaves nothing. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Bill.
You are fresh back from a trip to Scotland.
I am. We got back late yesterday afternoon after a full day of travel.
Yeah, and how did that go?
Well, you know, it was a fabulous trip. We had it was Hallie, my wife, and I, and our two oldest kids, and we had moved to Scotland 14 years ago when those two were ages 4 and 2 years old, and so there was this sort of weird and fun circling back to walk past these same streets and homes and all of that. Now, 14 years later, with your kids, it was a lovely experience.
And you had a lot of warm memories from that experience when you were there 14 years ago.
We did.
Did they all come flooding back? Pretty much.
You know, they do.
Sometimes you go back and you have these expectations and thoughts. They just don't match up.
Yeah. It's because I was in school there. We had to travel a few times in between that, too. And we found it was such a sweet time that first time around that every time we went back, we had to prepare ourselves for the fact that things would now be different. And we couldn't hang on entirely to the past. And so we had always these sweet memories that we were carrying with us. But we realized our first trip back after that, that it wasn't the same, and we had to suddenly be okay with that. And it just sort of taught us, I think, even some life lessons that the sweetness of the past I can be appreciative of, but I can't hang on to it. And so since then, all of our trips back have really been, they've been different. They've each been their own thing, but they are peppered with all of our past realities and relationships and stuff. So it's become a really sweet place for our family.
And just to remind our listeners, Peter teaches a class on sexuality here.
I do.
At the University of Northwestern. And Dr. Brad Sickler was in last week, and he was talking about a secular conference he went to where he picked up his name tag, and then there was a bunch of stickers that had pronouns on it. They asked you to peel one off and put it on your name tag regarding how you'd like to be addressed.
Yeah, and we just had a symposium among the faculty here at Northwestern a couple of weeks ago that I was doing some speaking at as well, and the shift to transgender and gender neutrality in our culture has been a real recent thing over these last couple of years. And that pronoun bit that you described is one of the main manifestations of it now. It's you can almost feel yourself in some context catching on yourself and saying she or he, because there's almost the sense you've got to feel like you're respectful where somebody falls. But at the same time, there's some 140 different ways in which people can identify themselves from a gender standpoint. So, and it can be fluid day in and day out. We were just reading some articles yesterday that, and Hallie was filling out some forms that were along the lines of, how are you identifying today? And so there's this almost recognition that it's not a prescribed category. You're really going back and forth on a daily basis these days about where you feel like you'd like to land on the continuum.
So God's gender is, right, neither male nor female.
Right, has the fullness, it appears, of yes. masculinity and femininity within God's self, right.
But there is an identification of him being the Father and Jesus being the Son.
Clearly.
So there is a difference between men and women, and there should be an authentic masculinity and femininity designed
sure.
by God.
For sure.
That we should be honoring and not convoluting.
It was interesting. It took me about 3 or 4 years to really get my head around for this class some of the research around same gender relationships, and then the picture shifted so quickly towards this gender fluidity or gender neutrality model. And so I've been, over the last maybe 18 months or so, you can find many spots in the biblical text in which the text talks about the specifics of masculinity and femininity. It may not be as easy to figure out what is true masculinity and femininity, and I think we have to be a little careful to just label stuff as masculine or feminine. But I think it's the invitation of where we are now as the church is to continue to explore from the biblical text where these incredible symbols and pictures of masculinity and femininity are, and then how they can play themselves out in our relationships with one another.
Mm-hmm. So, Peter, how do we walk this out every day? Let's just say, for example, and this happened to me once at a store, there was what appeared to be a man doing
yeah.
some stocking. I was looking for a particular item, and I said, excuse me, sir, can you tell me where? And when she turned around, I realized that I probably used the wrong pronoun, and I felt bad. I was embarrassed.
Yeah.
And then I was talking to a friend of mine, and I said, when there is a look like that and they get called by the wrong pronoun, are they pleased? And his response is, I don't know. You'd have to ask that person.
Yeah.
So how do we navigate this?
Yeah, I think there's a recognition that those kinds of experiences are going to be increasingly common as we're just doing our daily lives in the
mm-hmm.
malls and the grocery stores
yeah.
and wherever we find ourselves. And maybe not to beat ourselves up about that just because things are shifting so much. But I really think where the day-to-day opportunity is really is within our families. It really is in extended conversations in the church. We're just in these 15-second interchanges, we are going to mess things up. And a change agent kind of reality isn't going to happen there. But
mm-hmm.
what I'm finding by contrast is that churches are more and more interested in having extended, complex conversations about these subjects and not just trying to do 5 minutes here or Sunday school class here. So I know I'll be at a church over the next 3 weeks for an hour and a half at a WAC with about 60 or 70 of their adults.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about these things specifically for 4.5 hours. And hopefully that'll empower them to be with their families and have language. I think that's where we have to focus, because I know for me, I get distracted with worry sometimes, just being out in the world. Am I going to screw this whole thing up? But really where I think our invitation is to get into it much more deeply as a Christian community.
Yeah, and I'm always reminded just to encounter everyone with the eyes of Christ
mm-hmm.
and say, I don't care what kind of trouble you're in or conflict you're experiencing, or maybe you're not experiencing a conflict at all
right.
in your gender orientation or however you want to identify yourself. I can show up with the love of Christ
absolutely.
And just give you that.
Absolutely.
And not spend a lot of time worrying about that.
I think that's the critical point, is to lead with a forbearing spirit. I
yes.
love the biblical passage that says, let your forbearing spirit be made known. And so to lead with that, but if we so often will lead with a sense of condemnation immediately when we see somebody, as opposed to they're on a journey as well. They do bear God's image in the same way that I do, though. And I would hope that they wouldn't categorize me immediately based on some of the things that I might be wrestling with in my
sure.
life. So
sure.
can we lead with that forbearing spirit that doesn't embrace everything, but is along the way with the journey with one another and see him through the eyes of love
yeah.
first?
Peter, yesterday I interviewed Jeff Johnston. He's from Focus on the Family, and his son, Brendan, who's an 11th grader, decided that he would not wrestle a girl in the
yeah.
state boys tournament.
Yeah, I've been seeing some of those headlines.
Okay, so your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's understandable. I think this is where the rubber meets the road with the, I mean, it first started coming up with the Olympic athlete who was running as a female, transitioning for a male, or she had some gender ambiguity, and that was
mm-hmm.
about 10 years ago now, and she was blowing away the field. And just everybody was crying out foul. This is not fair for us to have to wrestle a boy slash girl or to run against a boy slash girl. We're not really certain. And I think this is where the confusion, where it all sounds maybe so good on paper for some people, this is where it really begins to come out. And I get it. You think about these high school or even college athletes, they spend all of their time and energy developing their athletic career.
Yes.
And then at that point, somebody decides to transition from male maybe to female as an 11th grader or 12th grader. And we have to wrestle with how that tips the playing field unfairly. Even if you're doing hormone suppression, and even if in theory you're maybe more feminine than masculine just from a hormonal level, which gets confusing as well. The whole thing, that's where it really melts down, and you can see the falsity of
it. And what about when this young woman has got a nice scholarship in the offing,
and all
of a sudden she doesn't win the meet she thought she would because a trans girl has come in and completely wiped out the competition.
That's exactly it. What I've found over the last 10 years is parents and students feeling so much pressure because university has gotten so expensive in our culture that they're doing everything they can to burnish their resumes and to try to get these scholarships. And that's legitimate. I mean, we're talking tens of thousands of dollars per family on the line over 4 years. And somebody can come in and swoop away a scholarship by identifying themselves as a different gender. It won't be the first or the last time that this situation presents itself.
Yeah, Peter, let me take a break. When we come back, I'll continue my conversation with Dr. Peter Kapsner. When he comes into the studio in the morning on Thursdays, he pulls into the parking lot and takes up two spaces, which I don't know why he does that. His car's not that nice. We'll be back in a minute. It is 18 minutes after the hour. We are back. Bill Arnold here with Peter Kapsner, two guys absolutely suited for radio. Peter, your wife just made a couple of interesting comments. She's up listening, which is great.
Yeah, she must be jet lagged. She's up early this morning listening. So I got some texts in for her, and she was talking about just the need to, as we have these open-spirited conversations with people that are maybe walking a very different pathway than what I might be walking, is how do we be open to not just being kind out in the world, but even developing relationships with people when and as it is possible and available, and to enter into with a real open-heartedness on that. Again, we're not talking about embracing all things, but I would have loved to have sat at Jesus's table. I have a feeling that it was a very open-hearted table where he laughed freely with people, where he affirmed the fact that they were human, bearing his image. And that very open table then can become a place where we can walk and grow together towards whatever the target of truth is that we're walking. But it has to start with this big open table to invite all people in. And so I think people can sniff it out if we are just having a forbearing spirit, but really staying resistant and all of that. I think, what does it mean to open your heart to all people? Again, we're not talking about opening our heart to all things. That's the tricky thing. But how can you have an open heart to all people? Because Jesus was filled with grace and truth, and those are two very important things to hold in tension.
Mm-hmm. And just a little side note to the wrestling idea, there are only 6 states that have girls' state wrestling championships.
Just 6 at this point?
Just 6, yeah. So it's kind of funny how we're saying that trans wrestlers are ruining girls' wrestling. Turns out there really isn't much to be ruining.
Well, at this point,
right? At this point, yeah.
But it is, it's been interesting, too, as in transitioning over to a different conversation about the hashtag MeToo movement, is that now we're in a women's affirmation month for some very understandable reasons. And I saw that yesterday, McDonald's, for the first time, turned their golden arches upside down to take that M and turn it into a W out of Women's Appreciations Month. And it sounds like a lot of McDonald's around the country are going to be doing that sort of thing. So I wonder if, give it 5 or 10 years, if many more states won't be, we'll be talking about having women's wrestling teams and maybe some men's dance teams. And it'd just be interesting to see how it plays itself out.
All right, Peter, more teens now are becoming trans curious. Now, is that part of the reason that we're making such a big fuss out of it? So they're finding that to be interesting, isn't? Don't we always want to look for the one source of rebellion that will make our parents the craziest?
Yeah. Well, it is something that you actually can trace over the last 40, 50 years in our culture. And I know when I was growing up that there was a curiosity. And back at that time, it really was about maybe some alcohol or some of those kinds of realities that can be part of teen life that do rebel against the existing norms. And I love the phrase that Paul had sent an article last week with this idea of social contagion, that among groups of young people, whatever is kind of the social curiosity becomes a contagion. And so for young people today, my understanding is that there's an identification that's about 300% higher of the potential to be transgender than the adult population.
Interesting.
And so it speaks to a curiosity that, and I think people, many of our young people have legitimate questions about their gender very early in life, mm-hmm. but the highest percentage of growth among gender curiosity these days appears to be among teenagers who now are wondering about themselves and coming at it from more of a social standpoint and deciding to experiment along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Because kids, when they're that young, they're going to be confused about a lot of stuff, aren't
they? That's exactly right.
And isn't a good doctor's prognosis regarding anything is to try and do a lot of things prior to drugs or surgery?
That's exactly
right.
I mean,
if you're trying to lose weight or something like that, and you go to the doctor and you say, for 20 years, I've been trying to lose weight.
Yeah.
Now can we have a discussion on gastric bypass?
That's, I think, exactly the point. Mm-hmm. And Bruce Ashford, who I know has been on your show, he sent me a link again last week around that one of the most famous surgeons in the world, I believe out of Russia right now, is he has ended the practice of doing a gender reassignment surgeries because he sees that post-surgery that the vast majority of his clients do not seem to be helped, that the confusion and the depression and anxiety and suicidal thoughts persist. But that's such a huge step to take to reassign somebody's gender biologically. And so really what's at the heart of this is somebody has a biological sex and then they have a gender, sort of the psychological sense of themselves that seems to be different than their sex. And it seems like maybe more of the practice is to look at why is somebody's gender sense of gender being not in alignment with their biological sex, as opposed to just assuming if we switch to the biological sex, that's going to fix everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge and traumatic process versus working over time, as you're saying, with somebody's sense of gender.
Well, my friend Patrick, who I have on the Mondays, we talk about what we call the now what principle. Okay, now what?
Yeah, right.
You know, all right, we've given you now gay people can get married. Okay, now what?
Right.
You still have to get up. You still have to pay your mortgage. You still have to lead your life.
Yeah, I think you sort of have this euphoric response of, and I remember when the big thing was coming out of the closet was the phrase we were using as a culture. And, mm-hmm. and when you finally took that step, there would be this euphoric response, I think, for people that they're out there and they're known and everything is now going to be better moving forward. But there really was a so what reality that would come as the realities of life settled in several months later.
Yeah, or now what?
Exactly.
You know, when Boris Becker won his second Wimbledon title, he was asked what he now considers to be his biggest challenge.
Yep.
And he said, not killing myself.
That's exactly
it. He was suicidal.
Yeah.
So you've won two Wimbledon titles. Now what?
It's something I think for all of us. I was reading just yesterday on ESPN about Ichiro, this famous baseball player for 20 years, with sure Hall of Famer. And he's talking about that the end of his career is coming. And he doesn't know what he's going to do with himself after the end of his baseball career. It is that now what reality.
Mm-hmm.
I think we so often look to the things of this world to bring a final satisfaction to our soul. And so often we do things and think that's going to do it. And then we realize 3 months later that didn't really do it. And now what?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, you get a PhD. Now what?
That's exactly right. Yeah. I'm working on three more, Bill, just so you
Good.
Know. I mean, I just, yeah, there's
Good,
so much
life
there.
Life is full of conflicting advice, isn't it?
I mean, you get
one of those old helpful hints books. And on one page, you read that you can remove a ketchup stain by using toothpaste. And then 10 pages later, you remove a toothpaste stain by using ketchup.
Yeah, it's just this vicious cycle.
Wait,
yeah.
Help me here.
I do. I run into that. I spent 4 hours going back and forth the other day between those two. And I kept saying, something is not working with this right now.
Yeah. Well, California's in a big pile of trouble as usual. There was a report last night on the news, which I found interesting. If you rent a U-Haul from Las Vegas to San Francisco,
okay,
it's $131. But if you rent a U-Haul from San Francisco to Las Vegas, it's $2,100.
Really?
Yeah. People are leaving San Francisco. You know, it's funny how they talk about being so progressive, but I think at a certain point people go, I'm kind of tired of this.
Yeah, I think that it is interesting to watch. There's a little bit it's not a civil war, but there's a lot of, you can see that there's some serious tension in California right now between the main hubs of the cities and the rest of the countryside. And I love watching or reading those sort of extremist articles about how they're going to break off from each other. And California is going to become now maybe the seventh largest economy on their own. They're going to secede from the United States.
Right.
Even Jeff Sessions, our attorney general, was saying yesterday that, or Department of Justice was saying yesterday, California will not secede from the union. Just the fact we have to to say these things. I know. It's just such an interesting time in our culture.
It's crazy. I don't know where Jeff Bezos lives. Is he a California guy?
Or is he in Seattle? I would assume so. Somewhere up in there.
He lives, right. You know, $129 billion.
And it just goes up by like a billion a day.
$39 billion last year.
Yeah. No, yeah, if my portfolio can go up by $10 a day, I'm feeling that's a serious day right there.
Yes. And maybe this is a little delusional how the left can be sometimes. CBS This Morning co-host Gayle King on Tuesday urged that her best friend Oprah run for president against Donald Trump. She even said that she could stay on at CBS and cover the race impartially.
I'm sure it'd be quite impartial. That was what was so
right.
fun.
Right. I feel like Dr. Evil.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And our friends over in Scotland were just amazed and with the idea that maybe we would see a President Trump versus Oprah 2020 cycle. They were even acknowledging they would be mesmerized by the coverage of that sort of thing, but also thinking, really? I mean, it's almost like we've approached capital status in the Hunger Games at that point. So.
Yeah. But what Donald Trump does for television ratings is insane.
Off the chart. Has there ever been?
Take him out of the picture and these cable companies stop making money.
That's exactly. I mean, if you just watch Fox or CNN, it's got to be 80% of their coverage dedicated. Yeah, would they cover? They'd have to cover people like us.
We're hearing music.
Oh, that's it, isn't it?
Yeah. We'll be back. Right. Peter's going to stick around. We're going to have John Blumen next. So from Desiring God, it's 27 minutes after the hour. I ran a little late, so we'll get moving here. It is 33 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break for news. And when we return, John Blum, author and board chair and co-founder of Desiring God, is in studio along with Dr. Peter Capps. We'll be back in a minute. Honey,
did I do? I recently received this question from a worried parent. Is there an age where it's too late to fix things? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Maybe you're at a place where you feel like there's no going back. It seems like your kids have gone off the deep end, and now they're even out of your house. My answer for this concerned father is this: it's never too late. God is always working in you, in the situation, and in your child. But you may have to set aside the idea of fixing everything. Perhaps now's the time for you as a mom or dad to trust God, to let Him bring about the restoration you desperately want and only He can do.
Get a free online parenting course called Tough Guys and Drama Queens at freeparentingcourse.com.
All I want to do is praise your name from the rising of the sun to the going down of the same. You are my God and all I want to do is praise your name.
22 minutes until the top of the hour. John Blum is an author, board chair, and co-founder of Desiring God. He's an author of three books, Not by Sight, Things Not Seen, and Don't Follow Your Heart. He is joining me in studio with Dr. Peter Kapsner. And welcome to a pilot episode of a new segment I just made up 2 minutes ago called The Arnold Group. Let's begin. Issue number one. How do I know if I love Jesus? John Blum.
Are you feeling uncomfortable, John? I didn't know I was invited. I got invited into a new group I didn't ask for. So, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh. So, so Bill wants to know how you love Jesus.
Yeah.
How do I know if I really love Jesus? Maybe that's the better question, because that's the title of an article that you wrote for Desiring God.
That's right. And it really is an important question. It's a serious one, because it's one that we all wrestle with. Because we know that love is a deep heartfelt affection. There's one sense of us that knows that. There's another part of us that says follows the idea that love is a verb, which doesn't mean that's disconnected from this deep affection. But you know, John Mayer's famous song "Love is a Verb."
Mm-hmm.
Love is a verb, but it's not merely a verb. Love is a noun. God is love. So love is a noun, and love is an adjective. So, I mean, love isn't merely actions. Love is a deep affection. But we know what love is by what love does. And where I get that from the Bible is John 14:15. If you love me, Jesus says, you will keep my commandments.
So I think, John, one of the things that I wrestle with relative to this is I see that passage of scripture and it feels like an indictment sometimes on my life, in the sense of I don't really want to obey Jesus' commandments, some of them, but I'm going to because I feel like I have to sort of prove that I love Jesus. I mean, who would say that they don't want to love Jesus? All of us want to be able to say we love Jesus. But when, if I'm honest with myself, there's a lot of which he asks of us and invites us into that I really don't want to do. And so how do I hold the tension when my sort of inside self, my hidden self, doesn't want to do these sorts of things? And I also don't want to just like go out and do a bunch of stuff, because then I feel like I'll be a hypocrite at the same time. So how do I hold the tension in this verse between what I desire and what I cherish and what I really love inside and doing these kinds of things?
So those are really two different kinds of questions. I think the first one is, how do you – I'm actually going to tackle the sort of the second thing that you said first, which is love isn't – you know, I might be tempted to go out and do a bunch of external things, okay? And that's how you can easily read what Jesus says. That's why that's a tricky – can be a tricky sentence to quote. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. Because you can point to Pharisees whose external righteousness – they might have defined as, well, we love God. Look at what we do. You know, love is what love does. But that isn't the whole story. And Jesus shows that by when he says things like, well, you know, you do everything you do to be seen by men. All right. So we can do lots of things that look like loving Jesus that are just external things that we do because we actually love our reputation, and we want people to approve us. The deep heartfelt thing that you're talking about. Here's what I want to use. There's one of my good friends and mentors, John Piper, uses an illustration to get at what when we say you've got to keep Jesus' commandments. What do we mean? And he talks about a husband who comes to a wife on their wedding anniversary, with a big bouquet of flowers, and he presents her this bouquet of flowers, and her response is, oh, that's beautiful. Why'd you do that? And his response is, well, a dutiful husband gets his wife flowers for her anniversary. It's not rocket science.
Mm-hmm.
It's my obligation. It's my duty. As a good husband, good husbands give their wives flowers on their anniversary. Now, everybody goes, oh, that's a bad answer. Why is that a bad answer? Well, a good husband does give their wife flowers for their anniversary, but not in that spirit. Mm. You do it because you treasure her, not because it's the right thing to do. And so we wear our love on our sleeves by what we do. You can't help but act out in the ways that love dictates. You will do what you love out of delight. That's the root of obedience.
Can we trust our own sincerity? Either of you.
These are great questions.
And great question.
This Arnold Club is
it's a big group. Arnold Group.
Get
it right, Capstone.
I'm sorry. I just paid my 59-cent dues. I think
that's because you got a discount.
Yeah, I did. The sincerity question, I'm compelled with that passage where God says, you know, you may not want to just judge your own heart. You may not be able to discern all of the realities of the heart. And so to be able to claim for certain that I was sincere in this action. But I think at the same time, I recognize when I'm playing some kind of Christian game, mm-hmm. when I'm mostly doing it because I'm scared of what God might think or other people might think, versus, as John was talking about, coming from this place of treasure and delight. And it's been one of the questions in my last 15, 20 years of faith is how do I actually begin to treasure and delight of the things of Jesus's kingdom and not just doing them out of a sense of obligation and responsibility? And what might that require? I think about our Vikings fans. They are not, you know, doing the skull chant and doing all of what they do out of a sense of obligation. They're doing it because somehow they're delighting or treasuring in the Vikings. And I don't think it's that different within the kingdom. But how do we learn mm-hmm. to treasure the realities of Jesus's kingdom?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out. There's a connection between Bill's question about, you know, can we trust our own sincerity? And then your question about What about when you don't want to do the things that Jesus is asking you to do?
Right.
Because we, you know, there's the nature of love. God has designed us so that we can't really hide our love. You're going to act out according to the things that you really love. And you can make it appear a certain way to people for some period of time, but you can't hide it forever. You're going to always obey what your heart really loves. You can't help it. But our hearts are disordered. Mm. And so there is – when Jesus says, if you're going to follow me, you must be willing to deny yourself and pick up your cross and follow me. And that ends up being the test of sincerity. And here's what I mean. Mark 10, remember the rich young man?
Mm-hmm.
I like Mark's telling of the rich young man the best because you got this man who's earnest. He runs up. Jesus is leaving town. He runs up, throws himself at Jesus' feet and says, what must I do to be saved? Jesus says, well, you know the commandments. And he lists off a couple. And the man says, I've done this ever since I was young. I've kept those. And then it says, and Jesus loved him and said, one thing you lack. Sell what you have, give them to the poor, and follow me, and you will have treasure in heaven. And the man could not do it. Now, Jesus, I think, loved the sincerity. The man was earnest. Okay? The man was earnest. He wanted to know what was wrong with his disordered heart. He knew something wasn't quite right. And then Jesus, with just a sentence, lays it open. Okay, if given the choice to God or money, what are you going to choose? And he made his choice. And his love was exposed.
All right, I have to take a break. This is the Arnold Group. We'll be back in just a minute. Peter Kapsner, John Bloom in studio. We are back. You're in the Arnold Group here now. We've got Dr. Peter Kapsner, John Bloom in studio. We're talking about an article that John wrote for Desiring God called How Do I Know If I Really Love Jesus? And John with and Peter with a disordered heart where we have idols all over the place. What does this mean to live in a way that we are going to be really loving Jesus?
So just to get back, I think, to bring to some sort of closure what we were saying about we left it with the rich young man. And how Jesus opened this man's heart with a sentence so he could tell what he really loved. And all of a sudden it became clear and he walked away sad. Now, the truth is we all have idols in us. We come to Christ sincerely. We are born again. And yet we still have remnants of indwelling sin, obviously. And there's this process of growth and maturity where we are confronted repeatedly with idols. And the wonderful thing about the Bible is you see it from beginning to end. All the saints of the Bible are defective saints. These are people whose idols get exposed. And, you see it in Abraham. You see it in Isaac. You see it in Jacob. You see Reuben making a terrible mistake with Bilhah. You see Joseph resisting Potiphar's wife. You see David doing a good thing with Saul, sparing Saul's life, and then you see David with Bathsheba. You just go right down history, and there's saints who love God but don't love him perfectly, and that's where we all live.
I think it's such an – that's – I know that's true of my own life as well, and we talk about this in class with students often, and you brought it up earlier, John, is this invitation, are you willing to set aside the things that I have allegiance to in this life? Maybe to use that phrase about the rich young ruler, he had allegiance to his money and his wealth and his title and his power. And what does that mean? And that does require sort of this invitation to die to the things of this world. But I think to see that through the lens of we're trying to appease an angry God or we've got to do all these right things is not a I think many of us are scared that God is angry with us as opposed to this is maybe going to be painful to give up the idols of our life, but it's coming from the heart of this loving Father who desires our freedom and our delight. And so it's much more of this invitation of can you just give up these idols, these things to which you're tuning yourself towards that aren't going to bring life and enter into the life with me. And so a loving invitation of a heavenly Father as opposed to we've got to do all this stuff to appease the angry God. And I think there's a lot of fear to really be real with ourselves about what we have allegiance to when it is that we're trying to appease an angry God versus saying, wait, God is for me. The biblical text just talks over and over about God being for us. And if that's the case, then these are invitations to a true way of delight as opposed to giving the allegiance to the false ways of delight in this world.
So the fancy theological word for appeasing the angry God, which is what you said,
right,
is propitiation.
That's a big word.
It's a big word, but that's what it means, appeasing the anger of a God. And Jesus has done that. Jesus is our propitiation. He took the wrath of God. And by Jesus wore his love on his sleeve. He did what love requires. By this we know love, that he laid his life down for us. God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us, Romans 5:8. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lays down his life for his friends, John 15:13. And so, like, God already knows all the idols of our heart. He is standing over us with this offer of, come to me. I will forgive that. My anger is assuaged through Christ. Trust him. Now, everything that I do to wean you off of idols is for your good. I am pursuing your good. I am pursuing your joy. I want you to be free. I want you to be joyful. That's the invitation. We have to believe what the Bible says about the way God views us and his motives over our subjective impressions that we naturally get because we know we're sinners, and so we can easily feel condemned, and we can have parents who are angry with us, and all sorts of reasons why we sort of have this knee-jerk response to God must be angry with me. But his propitiation, the propitiation was made in Christ, and so now God invites us in love to come.
Mm. Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, no, I think, again, and just to recognize that God's a sort of wrath is motivated by the distortion and the disorder and what's going on, but that he's not wrathful at us specifically. He's wrathful of the things that have brought such disorder that I think people sometimes live in the tension that God the Father is the bad cop who doesn't love us, and Jesus is the good cop who does love us, as opposed to the Godhead is entirely for us. And there's this tremendous energy against the sin in this world, but that energy wasn't against the core reality of my heart. I'm an image bearer, and he's here to rescue us, not to be angry with us, but now, you know, I guess I don't have to be angry anymore. The wrath was really poured out against the distortions and the idols of this world.
Yeah.
And we've always lived in the love of God, whether we could see it or not.
John, what if the idols of your heart involve addiction or self-medication?
Well, I think a lot of the idols of our hearts involve those things.
I do too.
And so our addictions are the places that they're complex. We're not going to make it simple. But
okay.
They're one of the places that we go to for joy or for, you know, pain.
Relief,
mm-hmm. All sorts of things, and plus there becomes like ingrained habits of response that become subconscious, and so they can be complex and difficult. But God means for us to become free from those things, and his invitation is to take drastic means if necessary. To pursue joy. That's what that's what Jesus says. If your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. We must take drastic measures, but the purpose here is freedom. For freedom, Christ has set us free. And you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And that ends up being the key principle. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. I'm not saying it's easy, but we all have to deal with it. The fight against sin and the fight to trust God's love and to trust his promises is a fight. It is a fight. But it must become a habitual fight. And over time, the habits of obedience will replace the habits of mm-hmm. sin.
That wraps up my pilot episode of the Arnold Group. Word of the day, propitiation. We'll take a short break and wrap up the show. We'll be back in a minute. Thanks to John and Peter. Have a great day. By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us. 1 John 3:16. Have a great day. I will see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend, and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.